Well, good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Wednesday, the 3rd of December. Very good to have you all here. I don't know about you. I'm feeling great. So I hope you are, too. I hope you're just having a fantastic day. And my name is Joe Donahue, in case you don't recognize the voice. It's good to be here. I don't know. This is the story I'm telling myself because I was out holiday shopping on Friday, and my mother-in-law was picking out a suitcase, and I decided to not be a part of that. So I sat down in a chair in the store, and I was next to a potpourri display, and then my throat seized up, but it hasn't fully left since then. But then it's just gotten progressively worse. I'm not blaming the potpourri anymore because I think it's something more than that, obviously, but here we are. I was hoping, but, you know, in a jam, I'll blame the potpourri. But anyway, good morning, all. Welcome to the program. Very nice to have you with us. Let me introduce our group to you. We'll get started. I'll let them do most of the talking today. The professor of political studies, Vice President for Academic Affairs and Director of the Center for Civic Engagement at Bard College, Jonathan Becker, joins us again. I've said this before. It's always great when you have new members to the panel. It's even better when they come back for a second time. That means that you got your hooks into them. That's great.
Yeah, and no, I'm really happy to be here. As I said a few weeks ago, it had been 25 years between visits to the studio in WAMC, and now it's 2.5 weeks. I'm a little bit worried that if it keeps on going that
truncated. Yeah, well, yeah. You may end up hosting the show by the end. So it's really nice to have you here. Thank you very much for joining us. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Bob Griffin. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Well, Joe, this actually is a dream come true for me. I've always wanted to be on a show with Barry White. So this is a momentous occasion for me.
Now, this is the conversation Ray and I were having just a few moments ago. Is it
Betty White, yes.
Barry White or Brenda Vaccaro? We were trying to figure out which of the two.
You sound like Barry White and you feel like Betty White.
There you go. That's
before I go, though, just a special shout out. The Road Crews, I thought, did a really super job yesterday. I know we don't give them a lot of credit, thank you for everybody who's out plowing. So thanks, folks.
I will be effusive in my praise. I will just have a small asterisk and say, for most municipalities.
For most, yes. There's always room for improvement.
I drove through a lot of towns and a lot of counties yesterday, and, you know, all roads are not created equal. But, man, the more rural, the better, though. They just work those roads, and it's fantastic. And so, yes, thank you so much. They work so, so, so hard. I had a question for you.
Sure.
I was at the Greenwich Lighted Tractor Parade.
Okay.
Are you aware of this?
I'm not, but I'm fascinated.
Okay. Now, the fact that you're not aware of it, it sort of reduces my fire here a little bit. But the Greenwich Lighted Tractor Parade is an event that takes place the Saturday before Thanksgiving. And tens of thousands of people come to our very, very small village. And we line the streets for hours upon hours upon hours because they shut all the roads down. And you stand there and you wait for tractors with lights to come down.
Yeah.
And it's lovely. It is true Americana. It is true small town America. It is lovely.
I'm sorry. Can I interrupt you for 1 second? And you're blaming the potpourri for your cold? Okay. Just clarifying that.
No. Well, first of all, inside. Second of all, alcoholic beverage. But two, I will say that. So I was talking to this guy, and there's all kinds of security and so forth, because this event started very small and got really big. And he said, yeah, my kid, it was working on this with the cybersecurity, emergency preparedness, homeland security, and cybersecurity at SUNY Albany, and was working on the emergency plan for this event, and he's been working on it for months. And I thought, well, that's my buddy Bob.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool.
That's the work that our students do. Certainly, we do it in conjunction with the response community and the state agencies, particularly DSHES, which is the Director for Homeland Security and Emergency Services.
DSHES. All right.
But it's sort of key and important to me is that the program really is both experiential, and it's very, very applied. So it's like how do you take from the classroom and bring to operations, because I think it's the best way to learn.
Well, I talked to the kid's father, and then I talked to the kid, and he was just pumped. Like, it was really cool. They did a great job. It was fantastic. It was a lovely, lovely event. But I wanted to pass that along because it was very cool to see that the work that comes out of that is being applied in our communities around the region. Bill Hammond is with us, senior fellow for health policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. Bill Hammond, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. This discussion about security at events like that, when you go to an event in Saratoga, they will close Broadway downtown, and they'll set up these barriers at each end of the closed road, which may just consist of like a some kind of dump truck parked across the road, but they also have these very intimidating looking like devices with spikes on them that you know. And I was thinking they should maybe fortify that even further with some bowls of potpourri to really scare people away, because that stuff is just a menace.
It's lethal. I don't know what the hell's in
I've
it.
I've been afraid of it since I was a child. So.
Yeah. I will say that I was thinking, you know, I'm the type of person, and because I know Bob, I'm even more this type of person, but I'll sit there and I'll think, well, if something goes wrong, how do I get out of here? You know, how do I get out of here? And then I look up and I see these amazing tractors with like 10-foot high wheels, and I think, well, there's my out.
Yes.
I think, yeah, let's go. We have Heather Mulligan, who I think is also under the weather, and joining us by telephone this morning, CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Hello, Heather. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. All right. It wasn't the potpourri that got me, though. It was probably the pub crawl that I went to on Saturday. So, I would argue a pub crawl is maybe more dangerous than a potpourri for most people.
Yeah, I was just going to say a little game for the audience, but who had more fun Saturday?
Pub crawl, like
I wish I had been at the tractor and lights. Sounds awesome, actually.
Oh, it's so much fun. It's so much fun. Well, let's get started. We'll talk about what is happening in the world here and get your take on it. Because there is a lot going on. We welcome you and your input, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so let's go to those stories making news. The term fog of war was used yesterday by Pete Hegseth. Let me put this into a context for you. This from the Washington Post. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said Tuesday that a couple of hours passed before he was made aware that a September military strike he authorized and, quote, watched live, required an additional attack to kill two survivors, further distancing himself from an incident now facing congressional inquiry. Speaking in the cabinet room alongside President Donald Trump, Hegseth delivered the most extensive public accounting yet of his involvement in the strike on the alleged drug smugglers in the Caribbean Sea. Lawmakers and law of war experts have questioned whether the episode constitutes a war crime, and if so, who bears responsibility? Here is what Hegseth said. I did not personally see survivors, he said in response to a reporter's question, because that thing was on fire and was exploded and fire. Smoke, and you can't see anything. You got digital. This is called the fog of war. That was the quote. Hegseth and Trump deflected responsibility for the killing of two survivors, pointing instead to the senior military officer in charge of the operation on September 2nd, Admiral Frank Bradley. And while they praised the military for conducting the mission, both sought to make clear they had not known that a second order was given to kill the survivors as they were clinging to the boat's wreckage. However, they made a point to say they supported the second strike. Trump said, I didn't know about the second strike. I didn't know anything about people. I wasn't involved. I knew they took out a boat. And he said this during a meeting with the members of his cabinet yesterday. Officials in Congress and the Pentagon have said they are concerned that the Trump administration intends to scapegoat the admiral and that they view Hegseth's public remarks as an attempt to insulate them himself from any legal recourse. Bob, I'll start with you.
Yeah, the fog of war, the fog of pub crawl. you know, there are so many concerning issues here that I'll sort of try to frame some and open up to the panel and we can come back to it. I think at the highest level, Joe, the question of the moral implications of what we're doing as a country and frankly, the conversation about what do we stand for as a country anymore? You know, in order to have the fog of war, you have to have a war. And the question is, under what part of our law and constitution are we at war right now? The other elements of this that really bother me are the continued, what I would consider to be the continued misuse of the military, the incompetence of the cabinet, certainly the diminished cognitive abilities of our commander in chief. I do believe, because I also saw the press conference with Caroline Leavitt, who really put the blame for this double tap, which is what this is now being called in circles in D.C. This sort of second attack on the survivors, which is a clear violation of rules of engagement. They're going to place this on the admiral, on the military chain of command, and then they're going to twist it on all of us who are questioning it as, you see, we're just disloyal, that we hate the country, that we hate the military, that we hate the uniform. It's the idea of not even being able to bring some of these, frankly, legal and moral issues forward without it turning into a continuation of the culture war, because the only thing that's working for them has been the culture war. Certainly their policies aren't working. If Hegseth didn't know, okay, if the Secretary of Defense, who now tries to brand himself as the Secretary of War, didn't know, I think that's just as disturbing to me as if he did. Because if he didn't know, then that means that the civilian control over the Pentagon and the military has lapsed to the point where we have problems.
So he has an answer for that. And he said, as you can imagine, we got a lot of things to do. So I didn't stick around for the hour and 2 hours, whatever, a couple hours later. I learned that the commander had made which he had the complete authority to do. And by the way, Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat. But I did not stick around.
His hands are still dirty. I mean, yeah. Again, you know, we've gone from you know, Harry S. Truman, who said the buck stops here, to this current administration where it's just a constant pass the buck. So this is pretty much standard operating procedure for both Hegseth and for Trump. But go back to this question, what do we stand for as a country? And what do we want our military to do? And are we being told the truth by our government? And I think these are all playing into this problem.
You know, the other thing that I think is interesting here, this story was broken by the Washington Post. They reported this on Friday that Hegseth had given a spoken order before the first missile strike to kill the entire crew of a vessel thought to be ferrying narcotics to the Caribbean. Then he now is out to get the Washington Post. But there's also this this narrative that they were all sort of let off the hook by an article in the Washington or in the New York Times that went against a lot of what the reporting was in the Post. I swear I don't see that connection, number one. But number two, also, over the last couple of days, the back and forth has pretty much corroborated most of both stories in the Times and the Post, which is, so I do think that is interesting as well. Jonathan Becker.
Look, I want to say, first of all, when you create a so-called Department of War, you get claims of war, even if they're extrajudicial killings dressed up as war. And I would just say at the start, I'm worried about this as a prelude to what might happen in Venezuela. The second thing I'd say is this follows the Trump playbook perfectly, which is, I don't know anything. It's a hoax. It's not wrong. It's someone else's fault. And if you question us, you're anti-American. So there's a lot of deflection. I think what Bob was talking about is really correct, which is, if you take a step back, separate from the murder of these two people, the whole policy doesn't follow international law. We're not at war. Right? The administration has refused to provide a transparent justification, either publicly or evidently to Congress, if what we hear is correct, about the legal basis of killing people for what is criminal conduct, right? And there's a big difference. If it's criminal conduct, you have a due process. You have international law, which governs things. This is separate from the killing of these two people who survived. And then the other thing that I think is really important is the claim is that this is about drug trafficking, right? And first of all, these are not, you know, this area is not a producer of fentanyl, which is supposedly what we're concerned about. The types of boats we're doing cannot come to the United States unless they refueled like 30 times.
Right.
But let's look at what also happened this week. You know, President Trump pardoned former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was convicted and sentenced to 45 years for being, you know, one of the responsible for some of the largest trafficking of cocaine in the United States. So if we're concerned about drugs, then that seems a very unusual approach. And the lack of transparency really, and I want to underline what Bob said, the corrosion of any sense of rule of law is what's so disconcerting about this.
Bill Hammond.
So by no means do I want to defend anything that's going on here. I don't think, like, there's no justification for targeting these boats in the first place. And then to have a policy of not allowing survivors after you've removed whatever the putative threat is, that's crazy. I don't, so the what Bob said earlier about what do we stand for as a country, I think we have to be honest with ourselves that the U.S. has done stuff in this vein before, under previous presidents. Not to the extreme, like, I guess what I'm thinking of are these targeted strikes against people that we believe to be terrorists in other countries with which we are not at war. Sometimes with drones, sometimes with, you know, guided missiles, whatever. You know, even if we send in personnel. And in those cases, there have been, you know, it's been a lot of collateral damage, right? So you target somebody you believe is a terrorist. Even if you hit that terrorist, you may also hit members of the family and other people who live near that person. So, and this has been going on. This has been, I think our reputation in the world is of a country that is willing to project force and doesn't necessarily worry about the niceties. Now, I think previous presidents tried to develop a legal rationale for what they were doing. There would be memos, they would keep Congress in the loop to some extent. They might even have some kind of resolution from Congress authorizing in general terms the use of force. So I do think what we're talking about here is an escalation. It's stretching the boundaries way beyond where they were before. But I don't think our reputation in around the world is so pristine, right? Like we've it's not the first time we've been accused of war crimes. I think we also have part of what's interesting to me is that people in these countries, like Afghanistan in particular, and Iraq and Iran, countries that we have targeted in this way, people from there want to come to the U.S. Nevertheless, right? We're still this magnet for international immigration because we also have a reputation for good things like, you know, liberty and prosperity. That's coupled with our reputation for violence.
Heather Mulligan.
Yeah, I don't actually disagree with anything that's been said. I mean, to me, at some point, people have to look at this and go, this is just wrong. You know, we don't, the fact that these, that they went back, I have a problem with the fact that they're blowing up the boats in the first place. Let's start with that. You know, they're not a direct threat to us. It's sort of this threaded together argument that they're transporting drugs. Even if every single person on that boat was involved in the transport of drugs, I mean, they were drowning in the water, and we followed up and killed them. I think that's horrible. And I think that the imagery of that, if it ever comes out, is going to be really damaging to us internationally. Not that we haven't already kind of crossed that bridge, but it's really, really concerning. And I, at some point, elected officials, regardless of party, have to start questioning the just in your face violation of sort of the rules of engagement that continually happens with this administration. I just can't believe that there isn't more outrage, but maybe I'm just not in the right
Well, there does seem to be a certain amount of outrage, bipartisan outrage in Congress of wanting to ask questions. Bob, is that enough, and is that placed in the proper context?
It's a step. I mean, it's a positive step that it appears that there's at least some in the GOP who are willing to even investigate what's going on. Which is a level of spine that we have not seen from Congress in a long time. A couple other issues that to go back to though, Joe. One is that I'll toss this on. I mean, it also shows the dilemma the Supreme Court has put us in with their immunity ruling, and would be remiss if we didn't put on the fact that the Supreme Court has given this particular president a get out of jail free card, and he's willing to use it because he has no moral compass, and he's surrounded himself with people who are just as feckless and are lawless as he is. The comments that are made that I think are really interesting is that the United States has dirty hands and a history of use of force. I think what you know, without getting into the sort of moral issues of how you rule, how you lead, some of the major differences, and I think we started to tease this out, is this is a legal question. It's the sale of illegal drugs. It's the trafficking of illegal drugs. When I think about Obama's use of drones to kill terrorist combatants, the link in my mind was that was to prevent a known or a suspected, but with enough intelligence to say that there was a clear and present threat of attack on American interests. This to me strikes me as different. This is where I would have said this isn't an area where you have a military intervention blowing up the boat. This is where you would have brought in law enforcement through the Coast Guard, the Drug Enforcement Agency, other law enforcement assets that we have in the Caribbean. You interdict, and then the rule of law then applies. And if these people are involved in it, then they're held accountable and taken through the court system. the same way that the former president of Honduras was. I don't understand how you could pardon one and not pardon others, but that's a level of hypocrisy that only MAGA can sort of get their heads around. So there are these issues, and there's also a reason, though, that until this Trump administration, we have tried to at least pretend that there is a veneer between law enforcement, enforcement of laws, and the military. That these are different. There's a reason the Coast Guard is in the Department of Homeland Security versus being in the Department of Defense. And these are all being blended in ways that I find really, really dangerous. Because to me, I'm looking at an administration that is more than prepared to use the military not only externally for law enforcement, but domestically for law enforcement. And that slippery slope is something we're on right now, and it's bad for the country.
So let's talk about the military for a second. And I want to focus in on Admiral Frank Mitchell Bradley. During his career, Admiral Bradley, a stoic and cerebral SEAL known as Mitch to his peers, has ordered and carried out military strikes against targets in Afghanistan, Yemen, and other war zones. This from the New York Times. Over the decades, he drew little attention outside the smoke and mirrors world of military special operations, but now he's facing his biggest professional challenge in public. After years of following orders with clear rules of engagement and with congressional authority targeting jihadists in rural and urban settings, Admiral Bradley was put in command of a legally murky attack on September 2nd, targeting a boat in the Caribbean that the Trump administration says was smuggling drugs. And in ordering a second strike that killed two survivors who were clinging to the burning wreckage of the boat, something his superiors say they did not specifically order him to do, Admiral Bradley now finds himself in potential legal jeopardy. Today, he will head to Capitol Hill for closed-door sessions with lawmakers as Republicans and Democrats express concerns about the Trump administration's campaign. I don't know whether this seems justified, but I'll just say it. I feel sorry for this guy.
It seems like what the writer of that piece is sort of framing is his superiors say they didn't order him to do to kill the survivors. But that's kind of the crux of the one of the issues here is you have reporting from the Washington Post that Hegseth did order him.
Verbally ordered.
Right. And so I guess will he tell Congress that that's what happened? Or are there other people who heard that conversation? So yeah, it's a quite... The writer's sort of trying to say that this could eventually lead up the chain if the admiral is willing to throw them, if he's willing to go there, or if he's, you know.
But I think he's between a rock and a hard place. I mean, what was the whole controversy over last week? It was over members of the Senate and the House of Representatives who had served in the military saying that members of the military should not follow illegal orders. So...
There's even some speculation that they were specifically referring to this.
It was this, right? Yeah.
Joe's concern notwithstanding in sympathy, what does he say? He either says he was following an order which was illegal and someone with that seniority should know that that was illegal, or he says I did it on my own, which is not a great position to be in. So it's a very difficult position that he is in because he has likely committed illegalities. And he's precisely done what those senators and congressmen advise people not to do because that is what the law says.
The thing about war crimes, though, is that it's kind of an abstraction. There's no one in a position to enforce if the president or the secretary of war or someone as high ranking as an admiral commits a war crime and the higher ups aren't inclined to view it that way or to take any action, there's nothing happens. I mean, I guess theoretically you could have a case made in some world court and, you know, the admiral wouldn't be able to travel internationally or something like that. But I just don't see any consequences
Well, the way the system is supposed to work, though, is that these are conversations that should have been occurring in the background. And there's a reason there are so many attorneys over at the Department of Defense, because they have cadres of attorneys who are looking at these very issues and giving a determination to the political leadership about what is legal and what is not. In a more perfect world, if the admiral gave this double tap order, okay, without direction from the president or the secretary of defense or whatever he wants to call himself now, then there is the military that he should be brought before a military tribunal, and if convicted, frankly, should be stripped of his rank, of his benefits, and should be in prison for the rest of his life.
But those are decisions that would have to be taken by Pete Hegseth.
And this is exactly the problem you have when you have elected a lawless administration or administration that feels that it's above the law. And this is also a problem when you have a Supreme Court that basically has said, you have a green light to do anything that you want to do because you can claim that it's part of your official responsibility. And this is where there's a special place in hell for John Roberts and members of the Supreme Court, because what they have done is that they have created this space that gives that gives this man the opportunity to be a king.
Heather Mulligan.
Yeah, I think going back to the comments by the Democrats that there's no obligation to follow illegal orders, the timing of that is interesting. I feel like there's a lot of speculation, obviously, and I'm sure it's been talked about already, and I think it was referenced, that they knew about this. Like, they had seen or heard that this report was coming, which, to me, then, what is the point of saying it publicly if it's something that's already happened? It almost feels like they're teeing somebody up. And I'm sure the point is to tee up Hegseth because everybody doesn't like him, for good reason. I'm not saying that they should like him. But all of that to me is just noise. I think the real question, someone needs to be held to account for this. I think it should be Hegseth if he gave the order. I just don't understand under what circumstances it's okay to bomb a boat that's not attacking us and given or whether or not it's leave survivors or don't leave survivors. I mean, there's a criminality to that you just can't get around. There's no declaration of war. There's no authority for us to be doing this, and whether or not it's been done in the past, to me is irrelevant. And as far as the Supreme Court goes, they're interpreting the law. I don't think you can say, well, they should have seen this coming, because their interpretation of the law wouldn't change regardless of what happens after. It's a structure of having to change the law. If you think that the law is not adequate, or you think that there shouldn't be immunity for the president under the current construct, then you need to change the construct, not the judicial interpretation of the construct. Sorry, that's a little wonky. Maybe it's a cold medicine talking, but, but my point is, they don't write the laws.
Weirdly, I understood it.
I wanted to just add two things. Like, if there's one thing the Trump administration is good at, it's throwing people under the bus. And so the question is, who's going to get thrown under what bus? And if I were the admiral, I would be concerned about that for sure. The second thing is that Congress has finally woken up. That this is the moment when that's happened is really both telling and important. Rand Paul has been very outspoken on this. He's called Hegseth a liar. And there's no doubt that the clock ticking on President Trump might embolden Congress. I mean, it's unfortunate Mike Johnson has totally abdicated responsibility in the House of Representatives for serving a check on the executive. And the last thing I would say is, for somebody in the military to be called a war criminal, to potentially face consequences under the International Criminal Court, for example, that is a significant thing, right? And it's a stain on their career. So I don't think that the Admiral Bradley is going away scot-free. And there's tremendous pressure under him, both from the Trump administration and outside. And we'll see where that goes.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters from listeners. We'll get to those and continue the conversation. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday, Wednesday, the 3rd, getting ahead of myself, Wednesday, the 3rd of December. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will go to a couple of letters. We have many, actually, so I'll get to as many as I can in the time we have before the top of the hour. Leonard said, don't forget, Hegseth fired a number of senior JAG officers at the beginning of his term. They have been planning to do illegal activities since the beginning. They just didn't expect to get this kind of pushback in Congress. That from Leonard. And I think that that pushback remains to be seen, right?
And that's, but I think the letter writer is correct that they purposely weakened all of the oversight, whether it was the whether in this case the JAGS, which is the judicial arm of the Department of Defense, whether it was the Department of Justice, or whether it was the Inspector Generals, the administration purposefully went in at the very beginning of the administration and sort of kicked out what I would consider to be sort of foundational protective bumpers that everybody else has kept. And this is where I get really upset with people like Grassley, who's been a huge supporter of whistleblowers and coming forth to tell the truth, and then sitting back quietly while the Trump administration just ran roughshod over a lot of these mechanisms.
Well, it seems like in a situation like this, the ultimate accountability lies with Congress. I mean, not sort of unfortunately because some of the guardrails have been dismantled or weakened, but also because the issue goes right to the top, right? It goes right to the Secretary of Defense and to the President, ultimately, because he's the one who wanted these boats to be blown up. And so there does seem to be some disquiet and, you know, concern in Congress that's being expressed, although it doesn't feel like it's loud enough to the point that it's going to dissuade the president from doing anything. Ultimately, it will come down to, like, if the public gets concerned about this, especially the Republican public, then the Republican Congress gets concerned about it, and then something happens. You know, they can put pressure, or they can threaten, or they can hold hearings or whatever, and that could lead to consequences.
There are so many dots to the story to connect to, but one of them also is the Navy admiral who oversees military operations in the region where U.S. forces have been attacking alleged drug boats off Venezuela, is retiring in about a week. He and the defense secretary announced that last month. Admiral Alvin Holsey became the leader of the U.S. Southern Command only in November, overseeing an area that encompasses the Caribbean Sea and waters off South America. These type of postings typically last between 3 or 4 years. He's gone after a couple of days and after the fifth strike on boats. So you just wonder what the message is there as well.
You think he's resigning in protest?
Yeah.
Protest or yes, or just.
And this is where I will not be at all surprised if the admiral in question, I have faith that he will tell the truth. How that's interpreted is good. It'll be very interesting given the partisan lens. One thing though that's been bugging me that Heather said is that, you know, Heather, one of the things that bothered me about the Supreme Court decision though is that they were given a number of sort of scenarios, and one of them was SEAL team actually being ordered to assassinate a political opponent of the president. And they heard that And I don't remember if it was Brown or Sotomayor who again referenced this, and they still didn't put any parameters around the immunity that they gave the president.
I don't think that that means that it's a good thing.
No, I don't either.
I don't think that that means right. No, obviously, but I guess my point is if there needs to be parameters, Congress has to impose those parameters. The idea of a Supreme Court being able to just write its own rules and regs, that's not how it works, right?
No, but they could have put
the law just doesn't provide for this.
But they could have put clarifying language in there. Instead, I felt that they gave that they left everything open ended on purpose, and I really thought it was sloppy on their part.
Yeah, I mean, I there's different views on how the degree to which judges can actually, have wiggle room around what the square lettering of the law says. And I think that, this is where there's a disagreement, right? I think the Supreme Court is very much leans towards kind of strict constructionalists. And like, if the language isn't there, it's not there.
Let's go to some letters that we have gotten over the last half hour or so. Jonathan said, please stop calling it the Department of War. I don't know, Jonathan, I agree with you, but I thought we had done it with enough sarcasm and cynicism that came through, but maybe not. The name was intentionally changed by the leaders of the greatest generation to define the difference between our system of governance and that of tyrannies, oligarchies, and kleptocracies. Civilian control of the military. The principle that we don't start wars was a core philosophy of the founders, even if they floundered in their attempts to achieve that level of social evolution. They established it as a goal of our fledgling social experiment. But I do think it's a good point. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Then we go to this letter from Mike. Trump administration officials has said that we are at war, killing enemy combatants that are clinging to a burning pile in an ocean is a war crime. Someone has to be held responsible for this crime. The question is who and whether it's justified, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, this idea, this issue of civilian control of the military has come up a couple times. I don't think anybody seriously believes that the military went rogue here, right? They were responding to what the Secretary of Defense and the President ordered them to do. And in fact, you could even make the case that this is an example where civilian control of the military gets dangerous, because the military, being professionals and having rules of war and rules of engagement and a legal structure and a whole cadre of lawyers who tell them what they can and can't do, would not do this on their own. They would not, on their own volition, go out and target a drug boat. The only reason they're targeting a drug boat is because the president told them to. There's a question of whether they had to follow that order, but they're not making this stuff up. They're doing it because they were under orders from the commander in chief.
But that's not what Carolyn Leavitt said. That's not what Hezgeth said. What I heard them say, and please correct me if I'm wrong, was we didn't know they were doing this. This came from the admiral. I mean, to me,
But the overall operation was. Coming from the top.
But to me, it's clearly trying to pass the blame on to the military chain of command and not take responsibility from what they did. I mean, am I reading it wrong?
No, I mean, I think the story has wandered around too. I mean, yes. I think it's changed at different levels and different days for different people. So it's hard to, it's one of those things where yes, what you say, like you're all right because. It so many different things were said as the reason. As I noted, that the original article that was published in the Washington Post on Friday. Quite frankly, I mean, most of those statements have been corroborated by someone within the administration.
Yeah, I mean, it seems the best defense right now is the fog of war defense, so that either, you know, it's Admiral Bradley's fault or everyone was confused and somehow mistakes were made. I do think, you know, when Joe, you refer to the Admiral Hosley stepping down, I would say that's precisely to avoid the position that Admiral Bradley is in right now, that is not a place someone would want to be. And then just the last thing, at least my notes say so-called Department of War. So if I left out the so-called, I apologize to the listeners of somewhere. But I would say that there's a logic there, right? And this is what's so frightening. You rename something, or not formally, but informally, and that a logic follows from that. And the logic from that is that you're using the military in aggressive and, in this case, illegal ways. I would stress that this is not a war. These are extrajudicial killings, notwithstanding anything that the United States has done previously. The other thing I think is interesting here is there are no names, right? When the United States has taken aggressive actions previously, I can't say always, but usually there were names of people who were being targeted. Here, nobody. The only names coming forward are from victims' families who are lining up now to sue the United States, which they should do. So nameless enemy combatants in an opaque justification for this leads to so-called wars, which are illegitimate and not really wars by any legal definition of war.
We are up against a break. Let's take it. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back first news with David Gustine. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have a good group today: Jonathan Becker, Heather Mulligan, Bill Hammond, and Bob Griffin. We welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. A couple more letters regarding the boat strikes, and then we'll move on to other topics. Cecilia writes, why would Hegseth and Trump want survivors killed? Could it be to prevent the leaking of proof that the boat wasn't actually carrying drugs? In a later raid, several survivors were detained. I don't recall ever hearing what happened to them. Do you all know?
They were sent back to their home countries. They were not sent to Guantanamo. They were not brought to the United States for trial. They were sent back to their home countries. I don't know what's happened since then, but one would think if that this is a war and that if you're combating drugs and that you have captured people who are purveyors of war crimes of some form, that you would want to arrest them and bring them to justice. But that is not what happened.
Yeah, I think there were going to be a lot of complications with, first of all, proving anything, but then second of all, the circumstances of their arrest, you know, like where the military just blown up their boat. It's just like that would be a very complicated case to make.
But the letter writer raises a pretty interesting question, and in part, and this is pure speculation on my part, is that one is that we have a very unserious administration, and it's much more ego-driven than it is the rule of law. And second is that they believe that they can intimidate others by these actions. And I think this does link with what's going on with Venezuela. And just think about this for a second, Joe. The fact that the president came out and made a statement about putting troops on the ground in Venezuela, which frankly should terrify all of us, it was sort of met with a degree of indifference that I find really disturbing. And this is where I completely disagree with Rand Paul on many, many, many issues, but his position on the differential of the congressional powers versus the powers of the president, I do agree with. And I do see the attacks on shipping as much a prelude to trying to strong arm Maduro in Venezuela as anything else.
I wish I didn't have to ask this as a serious question, but I have to ask this as a serious question. Do you think that the indifference comes from the that people don't care that there could be troops on the ground, or do you think the indifference comes from the fact that it's just a litany among the litany of things that is mentioned, along with pizza toppings and not being able to park in Manhattan?
I think the country right now is excuse the analogy, but you know we're underwater in a septic in a septic tank, and it's another mouthful of stuff from this president.
but I think it's interesting.
Well, you paint a picture, Bob.
I think it's interesting the amount of time Trump is spending on foreign policy, right? And he was the one who didn't want to be involved, engaged in wars in faraway places. And, it, you know, either in pursuit of the Nobel Prize or whatever's going on in Venezuela, which seems to be a declaration of, you know, reiteration of the Monroe Doctrine or whatever. I don't really understand. But I wonder politically, that is not what his base is interested in. And that's what, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene had the split with him. It was in part over that. And, you know, looking at his approval ratings, which are, you know, sinking to 38%, which is pretty much the lowest since January 6th, suggests that that isn't resonating. So it's an interesting choice on his part. I fear what you say to some extent is true, Joe. It's just yet another thing. It's better to talk about that than the Epstein files, I'm sure. but still, this is not what people who view America first, generally speaking, I don't think, are looking to do.
It's always been a dilemma. Like, do you take him literally or do you take him seriously? And I think this is a case where people aren't sure how to interpret his statements about Venezuela. Is he seriously talking about going to war there, or is he just, you know,
throwing it out there once again?
Yeah, trying to bully it just by saying things. He can. Well, there was a story today about how Maduro, the president of Venezuela, is taking active steps to prevent himself from being assassinated, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's moving around and he's brought in Cuban security. So he's taking it seriously, but he's, you know, he has more reason to than the rest of us.
Marion writes and says, are you kidding me? The idea that SCOTUS was constrained when making the immunity ruling is absurd. This constructionist Supreme Court makes up their interpretation of the laws to support their partisan beliefs. Their rulings either draw from 18th century lawyers in a time of witch trials or twist like pretzels bereft of any common sense. A law student making their argument would not have graduated. That from Marion. Let's go.
Oh, I just,
go ahead.
I respectfully disagree. That's all.
As our lawyer on the panel, yes, please. Let's see. I'm disturbed. Janet says, I'm disturbed by Hegseth's use of the word combat. There is no combat here, only extermination. Isn't the whole operation illegal and therefore a war crime? From a rational perspective, there is no justification for the strikes on these boats, let alone a double tap. That from Janet.
Yeah, and this becomes sort of that interesting question too. Since it's not a war, is it a war crime? But it's a crime, and maybe, you know, maybe so that we're just clear, you know, I believe a crime was committed in what was done.
I mean, the fact that the administration doesn't find the need to present either to the public or evidently to Congress the legal justification for the actions they're taking says a lot. And it says a lot about where we are in the country. And, I would agree with a point that Bob made earlier, which is it reflects also on what's going on in the country internally, and that is even more worrisome to me.
Let's see. Jeffrey from Holyoke. Jeffrey says, we cannot forget that it was just weeks ago that Hegseth told his generals to no longer worry about the rules of engagement. Could this not be taken as a broad order? That from Jeffrey.
You know, it's interesting because if you think about what Hegseth, and then when he did that weird, let's bring every general that we have in Admiral in so that I can pretend I'm important event. We're sending real mixed messages. And I actually appreciate Kelly and the other members of Congress who came out and reminded the troops that their oath – their oath is to defend the Constitution and the law. Trump's overreaction to that and the threat of frankly murdering the members of Congress who said that, I think shows that they hit close to home. But, you know, Joe, it's also trying to send a message to the good people that are in the Department of Defense and that there are people who are watching. There are people in powerful positions who are watching, and that if you do the right thing, it will be recognized and some level of protection will be put in place.
We got this final letter, and then we'll move on. Sars writes, what was the meeting that Hegseth had to attend in preference to the incident? Well, we probably won't know that, but it does. The mind wanders as to what it could be.
Well, and I think that's part of the problem with the administration is that it's wandering an awful lot from the top.
Let's go to other topics, and we welcome you, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So there was this, the Trump administration yesterday had a cabinet meeting, and my goodness, they're always fun to watch. They go on forever and all kinds of things. The president was awake for most of it, and he said on Tuesday, downplaying the cost of living pains being felt by Americans, declaring that affordability, quote, doesn't mean anything to anybody, as his political edge on the economy continues to dissipate. So all of those poll numbers that you all just referenced a moment ago come in large part because of the economy and affordability, but that is being sidelined as something that the president seems to be initially interested in. In remarks during a cabinet meeting, Mr. Trump railed against Democrats who have championed the issue, which helped the party secure several off-year election victories last month and is likely to be a defining topic in the midterms next year. After ticking off what he claimed were trillions of dollars of investments and other economic accomplishments, Mr. Trump called the issue of affordability a fake narrative and then referred to it as a con job that was created by Democrats to dupe the public. They just say the word, he said. It doesn't mean anything to anybody. They just say it, affordability. I inherited the worst inflation in history. There was no affordability. Nobody could afford anything unlike now. Jonathan.
I mean, it follows this pattern I was talking about earlier. It's not true, and it's somebody else's fault, right? I think that this is really a problem. The assertion, for example, that Trump made last weekend when he typed in all caps, I have the highest poll numbers of my political career. You know, the problem with the affordability issue is that people see this on a daily basis, right? Most people shop in stores. Many people are trying to buy holiday gifts. Most people try to feed a family at Thanksgiving. And what he's claiming isn't true. And I think what's important with these poll numbers are the erosion of his support on economic issues. So if you look at economic issues, you know, 4% of Democrats support him, have a positive view. It's only 28% of independents and only 81% of Republicans, which is very low for Trump, who commands tremendous loyalty within the party. That's his approval rating on the economy. So I think that this is a real weak spot, a real sore spot. You can't say both that it's not true and that it's somebody else's fault. And we'll see where that goes. But this is what's going to play out between now and next November when there's congressional elections. And this is, you know, it's the economy, stupid, going back to, I think it was Clinton. That is what the real issue is going to be. And I think he's very vulnerable here.
He campaigned to some extent on affordability. I don't know if he used the word that much, but He talked about how much inflation was hurting people and how expensive things have gotten and price of gas, and he also asserted that if he was made president the prices would come down,
day one.
Which that would be deflation, right? Like, I think he even went off on a little riff about how deflation is a bad thing yesterday. But the it was an unrealistic. He raised expectations about what was going to happen to prices if he was elected. Inflation has slowed. It probably would have slowed under any president because of the circumstances behind the inflation. It's slowed, and it's just that the public doesn't buy it. Like, for whatever reason, they perceive things to be worse than they are based on the economic numbers. And I mean, that this is a perennial issue with presidents, is that they, when they're campaigning, they assert they have control over the economy, and then once they're in office, the economy controls them.
It should be noted that yesterday, as he was saying that this is a con job and that nobody cares, and you mentioned this, and it doesn't mean anything to anybody, that exactly a week ago, he said that he was the affordability president and that he alone would bring down prices. So there is that. Heather.
Yeah, so I have this, my reaction to it is, as a former, you know, staffer to some elected officials, I just have this image of some of his communication staff going, oh no, now how are we going to spend this? This makes no sense. I mean, it obviously affordability is an issue. The election in New York City, you know, really put a fine point on it. They definitely know this, but I think sometimes in his musings, he goes off on these sort of, I don't know, rants that just are contrary to everything he said up to that point and contrary to what he knows to be true. And so I feel bad for some of the people who work for him. I mean, not really, but, you know, in the sense that they're always being forced into this position of having to contort themselves to defend something that he said that's just frankly absurd. And I know that there's another story that's another example of that that we were, you know, that was on our list to talk about today, which
yes.
I won't give it away. But it's like, you know, you say, he said what? And this is a guy that no one can control what he says. And this to me is just another example of something that he knows this is not true. But it's like a temper tantrum almost.
It is, because he can't believe that people don't love him. But, you know, I thought Biden, and frankly, I thought Harris made a huge mistake when she was asked, you know, what would you change about the Biden administration? And she said nothing. And Biden said, hey, the economy is getting better, when everybody was suffering. And Trump is doing the exact same thing. And, you know, Joe, if you think about the K-shape of where we are right now, the folks at the top are doing really, really well. Stock market, that's something that Trump points to. The folks at the bottom are doing worse and worse and worse. And the economy, in their minds, not only hasn't improved, it's gotten more difficult. And when you go in and you're looking at that, shelves being less, you know, there's fewer products, when you're looking at the cost of, frankly, everything. And I would challenge anybody to say to me that shopping right now for basic staples is less expensive than it was before, you know, than it was a year ago. I would ask you where you're shopping, because I obviously must be shopping at the wrong place. But it's this arrogance that what people are experiencing, they are absolutely experiencing, it's coming out of their pockets, is not true, is frankly infuriating. And if the Democrats are going to be successful in the midterms, and frankly, I think in the elections afterwards, this is the number one issue. It's the number one issue. It's the cost of living. It's the cost of housing. It's the fact that it is now more expensive. And the people who are benefiting the most are that small group at the top who, frankly, we're sending an awful lot of money to. I'll also note, and I know this is a little bit of old news, this whole thing about Marjorie Taylor Greene getting out of Congress, I mean, remember, she's getting out of Congress the day after she's vested in lifetime health insurance, and she's walking out of Congress with a kitty of something like $25 million. When she came into Congress, she had less than $700,000. The feeling in the communities was that the system is rigged. The politicians on both sides don't care about what's occurring, and this is also, and Heather, I think you're absolutely correct. I think people said, I'll roll my dice in New York City with someone who doesn't really espouse everything I agree with, but we need to do something different. And frankly, I think this is why Trump won in the first place as well. Mm.
That's the danger. I mean, it may be good political advice to say that Democrats should run on affordability and the cost of living and make that their number one priority. But the question is, when they get in office, what are they going to do about it? And if so, right now, inflation is now lower. It's not down to 2%, but it's lower than it was when Biden was in office, the post-pandemic period. That hasn't changed people's attitude. That hasn't neutralized the issue. So what are Democrats going to do beyond that? What are Democrats going to do? Mamdani's an example. Mamdani's program involves freezing rent and making buses free, things that he can't necessarily accomplish. The freezing rent he can probably accomplish, but he's overpromising on the economy is dangerous.
We'll pause. We'll be back. We'll continue and get our last words in after this short break from the BBC.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome Jonathan Becker, Heather Mulligan, Bill Hammond, and Bob Griffin to the program this morning. We welcome you as well. I want to just mention we've had a couple of letters asking who is providing the music this morning. It is the Faux Pause, F-A-U-X, Faux, P-A-W-S. Pause. See what they did there? Faux pause. And the playlist is on our website, wamc.org/roundtable, wamc.org.
It's music for a tractor parade.
You know, all music is for a tractor parade. We welcome you as always. All right, we have a few minutes. Let's finish up and get to some other things that we can discuss. On this day, does anybody want to talk about the Tennessee House race and make anything of it?
No.
Okay. Anybody else? Heather?
Nope.
Okay.
No. Yeah, just one quick comment. I still think it comes down to you've got to run the right candidate. And looking a little bit at the race, I thought it was a reach. I thought it was overblown. But I also think that the candidate had the Democrats put up had some considerable issues. You can't run out of Nashville against country music. You know, it's just sort of some of those elements.
So what they were doing is they were saying, look, Trump won by 26 points. What's this candidate going to do?
Right.
He lost by 6 points, and they're saying, well, this does tell us something, perhaps.
I would be reluctant to extrapolate this into the continuation of a blue wave. But I was also uncomfortable with the hype that it was being given, even before the results were in.
I mean, I think a reduction of advantage by President Trump from 22+22, I think it was, to +8, it's not insignificant. It doesn't tell us everything, but it's interesting. I also think there's another story to tell, which is that district was totally gerrymandered, right? Yeah. Dividing up one solid blue seat into three different seats. And that might be the biggest story of what we're going to hear about in the 2026 election. So that is the harbinger, I would say, about this race.
All right. Note to self, I should have asked you that question first. Okay. let's go back to the
the cabinet meeting that took place yesterday, Heather mentioned this in a previous answer, and it's something I did want to get to. The president called Somalis garbage and saying he didn't want them in the country. It is no shock, I think, that the president has a history of insulting people, certainly from African countries. But the outburst was shocking in its unapologetic bigotry. Add to it Vice President J.D. Vance banging on the table and hooting and hollering in encouragement as this was taking place, that came off as an odd visual, let's say. President Trump unleashed a xenophobic tirade against Somali immigrants on Tuesday, calling them garbage and does not want them in the United States, in an outburst that captured the raw nativism that has animated his approach to immigration. Even for Mr. Trump, who has a long history of insulting black people, particularly those from African countries, his outburst was shocking in its unapologetic bigotry, and it comes as he started a new ICE operation targeting Somalis in the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. Quote, "These are people that do nothing but complain," Mr. Trump said. And this is not in the article, but I just want to add the word. Like, if I had the chance to rewrite this, I would say, "These are people that do nothing but complain," Mr. Trump complained. He said at the tail end of a cabinet meeting at the White House, during which he sometimes appeared to be fighting sleep. But when the subject turned to immigration, Mr. Trump made a point of lashing out and strongly. "When they come from hell and they complain and do nothing but bitch, we don't want them in our country. Let them go back to where they came from and fix it," Mr. Trump added as Vice President J.D. Vance banged on the table in encouragement. He said, "Somalia stinks. We don't want them in our country." He described Representative Ilhan Omar, a Democrat of Minnesota who came to the United States from Somalia as a refugee and became a citizen 25 years ago, as garbage. "She's garbage. Her friends are garbage. These aren't people who work. These are people who say, let's go. Come on. Let's make this place great."
It's just, there's just no other way to describe it but disgusting. He's so far from what we expect of a president, of a political leader, in terms of his demeanor, his attitude, his rhetoric. It's all awful. I mean, the presidents in my lifetime, in any way, you could disagree with their policies, but they always took pains to at least pay lip service to the idea that bigotry is bad and that we, all people should be treated with respect, and we don't denigrate somebody because of their nationality or their ethnicity or their race. That has just been sort of rock bottom, basic, minimal, acceptable behavior of a president. And this president just doesn't care about any of that. And no. I think it's actually dangerous because, and it this is true of poisonous rhetoric in any situation, but when it comes from the top elected official of the country, somebody with an enormous following, like everybody's paying attention to what he says. He doesn't like speak into a vacuum. There's a danger that he's going to incite people to do things based on his rhetoric.
Heather?
So I actually initially thought this was like a story from The Onion, because I couldn't, it's so crazy sounding, right? And it reminds me of like a kid who's overtired acting out, which is, the context of the story that he was yawning, he was falling asleep, and then he comes out with this. It just, I think even for Trump, it's just bizarre, and it's way, way, way too much. I mean, you can't just do that as president of the United States. And so I actually initially thought it wasn't real. So I'm flabbergasted. I mean, I know, shouldn't be surprised. This is who this guy is. But at some point, like, they got to stop letting him out in public is all I can think.
You know, it's funny you mentioned this. I was thinking of this earlier today, but there were those moments during the Biden administration when Biden would get done speaking and he would start to walk to the wings, and he would kind of wander off, and then there was a moment he'd stop, and then he'd go back to the podium, and you would just see all of his advisors in the side like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, and you get the same thing here where. There's that, as you say, he was nodding off, but then there was that spark, and then it went, and you just see the people on the side of the room go, oh boy, oh God, all right, here we go.
Or they bang on the table.
Well, in the case of J.D. Vance and other members of the cabinet, yes, that is what they did.
I mean, I'd be happier if he was asleep. I would just... I would just say, you know, to what Heather
Let
said, I mean, look, my note, though, note
Maybe
I wrote to myself.
Maybe it's time
is,
for a nap.
Yes. But
I'm going to put you down for a while.
Donald Trump's whole career, political career, is that he's in his happy place when he could attack immigrants and people with dark skin. And that's what he does. He dehumanized people, and that's what he did when he denounced the people for committing crimes in Central Park. That's what he did with President Obama, saying he's not a citizen. That's what he did people from S-hole countries last time around. And I mean, two things. First of all, I work with a lot of immigrants. At Bard, we have a lot of people who came, including from the countries he's targeting, the 19 countries that they're halting immigration processes from. And this is so corrosive to these people who came here legally, people who have green cards, who have been vetted, who are even on domestic flights being challenged as to whether they're legitimate citizens and really being harassed. And I the other thing I want to just say on the opposite, because I wanted to mention this. Last night I was at an amazing event in New York for R.A. Nair. R.A. Nair came to the United States after Kristallnacht from Berlin. He ended up first in the United Kingdom, then the United States. He ended up heading the ACLU, Human Rights Watch, and the Open Society Foundations. And to see somebody who fled terror, who came to this country and had such an amazing impact because he emphasized things like due process, rule of law, and that dissent is okay. He famously defended Nazis marching in Skokie, Illinois, in spite of the fact that he was a Holocaust survivor. And the wonderful thing that immigrants have brought to this country, juxtaposed with the dehumanizing language that Trump has used, is not surprising, but nonetheless saddening and disappointing, and does not reflect well on the best of this country.
We are out of time, but I want to thank everyone for being with us, all of our panelists who were wonderful today. Heather, I hope you're feeling better. Thank you very much for making the attempt, even being under the weather.
Thank you. You sound better, too.
All right. Thanks. We go to, we also want to thank Bill Hammond, Bob Griffin, and Jonathan Becker. You're all wonderful. Thank you. We'll be back right after this.